The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and after being on the island for 44 grueling days, what candy would I eat before sneaking out of the food storeroom? I would eat those Reese's peanut butter cups, so none for Claire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to snatch some candy as I went up into the vents, like a badass like Kate, I would grab Red Vines, but not Twizzlers. This is very important. It's a regional thing. Red Vines, always. Twizzlers, never.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I come from Twizzlers country to tell you two things. One, if I were in the food closet where Kate ends up, I would take not candy, maybe some real food, but I understand the candy thing. Two, and I want to emphasize that this is the proper pronunciation of this candy, Reese's Pieces.
Reese's Pieces?
Not Reese's Pieces. Reese's
Wait.
Pieces. It's a guy named Reese, and he's got some pieces that he's going to give you.
I have a question about
Yes.
the Reese's Pieces. Would you...
spoken like a true Red Vine person.
Would you take a handful? Well, what I love is that people I say Reese's Pieces because I'm not a monster. But what I love about Reese's Pieces is people start pronouncing pieces like it's pieces, not pieces. Anyway, the Reese's Pieces, would you take like a bag or would you like grab a fistful of pieces?
Oh no, I'm doing the Kate thing. I'm taking multiple bags and stuffing them down my pants. Like, because you notice that not only does she take a candy bar and eat it, but she stuffs like six in her back pocket, which we'll talk about later. Only Kate can apparently find her pockets.
Yeah, apparently. I was talking to Dave about this when I was preparing for to interview our guest this week. And one of the very, very backup questions I had was like, what was the Apollo bar made of? Because I know eventually they made an Apollo bar, but that one just definitely looks like a power bar to me. It didn't look super appealing. It looked like a power bar masquerading as a candy bar.
One of those crappy candy bars you buy from like, you know how they have like those book sales at school, but they also did like candy sales, but the candy bars kind of sucked.
And it'd be like chalky.
Right. And it was like the off brand. Anyway,
I feel like they put a power bar in a Apollo wrapper because Evangeline Lilly, who has a lot of muscles to maintain, was like, I will eat something made of acai berries, but I will not eat a fucking candy bar for you guys. So I don't know. That's the thing about eating on screen, because she probably had to take like many bites of whatever that was, many takes. So
yeah, it would suck to have to eat that candy bar like 30 times in a row at work.
All right. This has been your Apollo Bar check-in.
This is, of course, the podcast that is rewatching the ABC series Lost. We've made it up to season 2, episode 2, Adrift, the one where Kate eats a candy bar and other things happen. If you want to support us, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there we do some extra bonus content for different contribution levels. But of course, the $1 level, you get into our Slack, which is the best place on the internet to discuss Lost, anything else. Occasionally, I just jump in and see what they're talking about with video games, because I like to talk about video games. But this is a Lost podcast, so I should tell you how it works. We split our show into two parts. There's a calm section. There's a storm section. The storm section has spoilers beyond season 2, episode 2. We have some different names for the hatch and things that we could talk about there. But the calm section will be for our people who are rewatching with us, maybe for the first time, and have just discovered Desmond down in the hatch last episode and are sort of catching up on this hatch in the jungle of mystery. One more reminder before I get done talking. We have a live show coming up on November 21st in Boulder, Colorado at the Canyon Theater.
Woo-hoo!
At the Boulder Public Library.
I got a plane ticket and everything.
Yeah, it's definitely happening. Neil has his plane ticket. We're going to be talking about Star Wars by that time. We're going to be going through the first 6 episodes of Lost Season 2, taking a little break for Star Wars, because I don't know about you guys, but it's already, the Star Wars mania is creeping in at the sides for me. We got like Mandalorian coming up. We got Rise of Skywalker coming out in December. We're going to celebrate that by talking about the Star Wars universe, starting with the first 3 like main Star Wars movie, not the first 3 chronological Star Wars movies at this live show.
You know, you could just say original trilogy, right? Is the 2-word phrase you were looking for, right?
That was the thing I could have said.
Okay.
But more words.
Yeah,
more words.
I think that's what we're talking about in Denver.
More words, better.
More words, better. Excellent. Joanna, do we have any reviews for this Lost Rewatch show?
Oh, sure do, Dave. Thanks so much for asking. That wasn't even stalling. I just thought I'd be a little jerk. All right, so this review is from Micro Marathi. I feel like I'm missing how the words are supposed to be broken out there. Marathi.
Punctuation and spaces are important.
Well, no, not in
the internet age.
Yeah, but in iTunes, you don't have that option. That's true. Micro, perhaps. Maybe. Let's see. Okay. Great host, great podcasts, / a request for theories, 5 stars. I love these hosts and hearing their conversations on all things pop culture. I've been meaning to watch Lost for a while now, but always deleted because I couldn't experience it with a fandom while it was coming out. Now I can. If possible, I'd love to hear the major theories people had at the time the show aired in the calm. I started watching Lost because as a Slack member, I can share theories with other first-time watchers. I realize in calm discussion of theories might be difficult because some are true and some are not, but perhaps it could just be stated as a theory of the time and not comment on if it's true or not. I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but since I can't Google theories freely, I'd love it if the host could share what theories people had at the time the episode aired. I think that's a great request, and we're going to try to do that.
Maybe. Yeah,
a theory
I like
corner,
that.
Just like theory at the time, and then we'll do our best like poker silence face. It's easy to do a poker face on the radio.
We'll just bleep for like 4 minutes after we talk about the
Yeah, so you can leave us an iTunes review. We love it. You can go to stormpodcast.com if you want to know sort of like what we're up to, what we're doing, live shows as they're announced, etc. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter @stormpodcast. I'm going to read a quick email from one of our listeners who emailed us at host@stormpodcast.com. This is sort of a look back to the finale. Patrick wrote this in a little late about the season 1 finale. Patrick says, I was intending to nominate the appearance and death of Arts as the most 2004 thing about the episode. Bear with me here. Not sure if any of you were watching live during season 1, but during the week leading up to the finale, ABC was heavily, I could not believe it when I read this email. The audacity on ABC. Okay. ABC was heavily running a promo with a voiceover. One of these characters will die, he said, to be read. He said, to be read with your best movie trailer voice. So hopefully I did. Okay. accompanied by long lingering shots of Jack, Kate, Sawyer, Charlie, Locke, and then a quick flash of Arst. My headcanon states that Arst only appeared in Lost so that he could make this promotional montage possible, and that the ABC marketing folks ordered the Lost writers to write a disposable character into the last non-finale episode of the season so that they could generate a slight ratings bump for the finale by teasing the death of a major character, the last part being a common network tactic at the time. If this is all true, can you imagine a popular auteur-led show today being ordered to write a new character for the penultimate episode to be killed in the finale purely for marketing and promotional purposes, et cetera, et cetera, the internet backlash, blah, blah, blah. So for these admittedly convoluted reasons, I nominate the appearance and death of Arst as the most 2004 thing. Thanks, Pat. I think we know that's not the case, that Damon Lindelof wrote this character and to have revenge on his science teacher, right? His high school science teacher. But can you imagine, like, how, if we were a Lost podcast at the time, how much shit we would give the network for their one of these characters will die? Also, I also think maybe even in 2004, we would have been savvy enough to be like, oh, could it be
it's the new be guy? Yeah.
We definitely would have been.
5 minutes into record. The episode.
See a record of having to pretend like Jon Snow was dead for
that guy ain't dead. Okay, so thank you so much, Pat, for that email, and for if anyone I doubt you'll be able to find that promo, but if you can and want to send it over, I would love to watch it. Our guest this week, I'm so excited for you to listen to this. Our guest this week is the director of this episode, Stephen Williams. He's a director of many episodes. He's also eventually wound up being, and they get very particular about these titles, so I hope I got it right, co-executive producer of Lost. And essentially, by the end of the series, he and Jack Bender, who you've heard us talk about a lot, and this other person whose name I can't remember right now, Gene something, basically ran Hawaii, you know, while everyone else we know and love was back in Los Angeles. So Stephen was just like a huge, huge part of the show. He also is working on the TV series Watchmen. He directed he's an executive producer over there. He directed a bunch of episodes of Watchmen. He directed the best episode of Watchmen, which you will get to later in the season, and you will be like, oh my God, this guy's a genius. So like, pay attention now.
But then you'll be like, oh my God, I already knew that because I listened to this awesome Lost podcast that told me about him.
Yeah, his interview's great. He's so lovely. He's from Canada, so he's got this beautiful way of speaking. We talked about Michael. We talked about Last Minute Changes. Anyway, listen to the interview. It's really great. It's really, really good. So all due to him, thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us. We talked a little Watchmen, but mostly Lost. So I'm done.
All right, that'll be coming up after the call, which will be coming up after we pause to talk about teeth.
You said teeth with an F.
I did.
That's really cute. Let's talk about the holidays. I know, it's crazy early to talk about the holidays, but trust me, you don't want to go through another holiday season taking closed mouth photos while everyone else is grinning ear to ear, do you? Getting a photo-ready smile starts now, and it's easier than ever with clear aligners from Candid.
Candid's aligners can help strengthen your teeth faster than traditional wire braces. Treatment just takes 6 months on average. An experienced orthodontist who is licensed in your state creates a custom treatment plan, then they show you a 3D preview so you can see how your teeth will look after you're done. Candid's aligners are comfortable, removable, and completely invisible. Candid ships your aligners directly to you, so there's no hassle of going to an orthodontist's office, and Candid costs 65% less than braces. And with each aligner purchased, Candid donates $25 to Smile Train, who brings safe 100% free cleft lip and palate treatment to children around the globe.
Whoa, Smile Train. Get your photo-ready smile by the holidays. Go to candidco.com/storm. And use code STORM to get $75 off. That's candidco.com/storm. You know how to spell storm. Code STORM for $75 off. candidco.com/storm. Code. What was that code?
STORM.
Awesome.
STORM. And we're back to talk about the calm. Neil, what happened this week on and slightly off the island?
Well, Dave, as you've mentioned, it is episode 2, season 2, Adrift. This episode was directed, as we've also mentioned, by Stephen Williams. It was written by Stephen Maeda and Leonard Dick. It aired on September 28th, 2005. It takes place on days 44 and 45. I'm guessing most of the water stuff is the night between those 2 days. In flashbacks, we learn pretty simply how Michael gave up his rights as Walt's father. We learn that Susan is a pretty damn good lawyer, and the whole thing's pretty heartbreaking. On the island, we visit with Sawyer and Michael, who we did not visit with last week. In the aftermath of Walt's abductions, one of them screams Walt, the other one screams Jin. There's a lot of screaming. A shark shows up. It's interesting. Sawyer takes a bullet out with his bare hand, and then they do some therapy. Elsewhere, back on the actual island, we learn what happened to John and Kate before Jack showed up at the hatch. They meet Desmond. Kate gets locked in a closet of food, almost gets shot, and definitely was the one who yelled Jack in the background of last week's episode. But you can only really see it if you watch it with the subtitles on. We'll get back to the subtitles here in a second. We also check in briefly with Charlie's drug addiction, and guess what, guys? I think it's still there. I think it's coming back. He's really, really thinking about it. The whole episode ends with Michael and Sawyer making it back to the island, finding Jin, and then getting captured by mysterious, and I say this like this only because that's how it's written in the subtitles, Udders. I know, it's just, it's U-D-D-E-R-S in the subtitles.
I know, I remember.
Who's the racist here? I think it's the subtitle guy. Anyway.
Well, they were trying, like, he says it one way, and then he, like, further articulate, so they like try to do like
right. They're doing like phonetically what he said.
We are like, come on, guys. Maybe give us others with like a U-T-H-E-R-S. I would have preferred, and then O-T-H-E-R-S. Right. Thanks, closed captioning.
Yeah. Fun fact of the week, courtesy of Lostpedia, which we talk about a lot, which our calm listeners should not go to if they don't want spoilers, because there's a ton of them in there. When Michael is talking to his lawyer, we get a very brief glimpse of the World Trade Center towers, which is the most pre-2001 thing of this episode. Also, that means that they would have had to put those in, because this would not have been made until after they were already gone. So they made a conscious choice to have those in there behind Michael. This week's calm question... And this is a fun one, because I don't think there is a good answer. How did Sawyer know that Russo said the others were coming for the kid? The raft had already set sail by then.
He watched the finale.
Yeah. The raft.
On his Apple Watch.
Yeah. Probably one of my favorite plot holes is the Sawyer being like, yeah, she said they were coming for the kid. And immediately you're just like, wait, you weren't there for that.
But you weren't there.
That's what happened this week.
That's the last time there will be any kind of funkiness with continuity on Lost.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. Don't go looking everything for any more because it's all buttoned up from here.
Everything else is going to be perfect. Where do you guys want to start this week? Do we want to start in the flashbacks? Do we want to start out in the ocean? Do we want to start back in the hatch? Or do we want to start in the caves with Charlie pretending the Statue of the Virgin Mary might become important later on for these survivors?
I want to start... I want to start by asking Neil why his recap of this episode didn't say Kate is tied in a pantry in a hatch of mystery.
Well, I don't want to overuse that very fair. Good joke.
Fair. Okay. Anyway.
There's a lot that happens with Kate. I think we should start with the hatch because I have something to say about that. I really appreciate our guest this week, Stephen Williams, as a director, the patience that this episode has at the open, especially with the lock stuff, because it at first it's a little jarring because we're going back to see stuff that we already know kind of what happened. We know where Locke ends up, and it's a very brave thing for a show to then double back and tell that story again and keep it compelling. But I just love the sort of steadiness of the steadiness and the quietness of the scene where Locke is coming down and you see him like take off his shoes, and it's just got this really sort of eerie patience to it that I love from like a filmmaking technique, because if you think about where Lost was in season 2, they had come off, you know, creating all these great mysteries at the end of season 1, and season 2 has this incredible pace to it that we're going to start to see ramp up, but it was kind of fun to see it, you know, slow down and just sort of walk us back through this thing that happened from a different perspective and keep it interesting, because, you know, we get Kate getting the food, and the conversation between Locke and Desmond is great. So I think that that is, it's both a brave choice creatively, and I think they really nailed it. You know, from a filmmaker, from just the way you sort of ease into the episode is really interesting to me.
I agree that it's a brave choice, mostly because every one of these plot lines begins with a rehash. We're either, you know, back in the top of the hatch when Locke goes down, or back in the water with Michael screaming Walt, or in the case of the flashback, back in the Michael custody agreement, which makes it really frustrating because I like this flashback after having, you know, had the conversation for a previous Michael episode with Matt Patches about trying to rethink how fatherhood works on Lost. This one actually works on me, with the exception that I already know that his, you know, Walt's mom, like, has no intention of, like, letting Michael write to Walt, or, like, when she leaves at the end of this episode, she's gone until, you know, Michael has to come and, like, take over. So it makes it, like, a little bit, I guess more heart-wrenching, but also more difficult to watch, just knowing that
she's dark, knowing turn that, because we already know about the letters, because that was a big thing in that episode, the previous Michael episode. So we know that she, like, withheld that stuff from Walt for years. So that makes this whole thing a little bit darker.
So we'll get into it a lot more with our guest, but like what's true about this episode, a lot of people complain about this episode. It actually got like a bunch of negative reviews when it came out and stuff like that, because it feels like, yeah, a retread of stuff we already knew, et cetera, et cetera. I actually really love this episode. It's far from the strongest flashback, and the reason why is that this was originally supposed to be a Sawyer episode. This is the Tampa Job episode, and they shot the flashback. There's actually images of it online that you can see. A couple things. That plot line was basically, and once again, I'll get into it with Steven, but that plot line was basically repurposed for a later Sawyer episode. So you didn't really miss much not having it, but that left them, like, according to Steven, I think some people expect that the flashback was bad of Sawyer, and that's why they cut it and sort of tried it again later. And it might have been, like, the network wanted them to have a Sawyer episode. That's what they wanted. Steven, this many years later, didn't say that, but he did say that, like, they felt like it was wrong to focus on Sawyer here when Michael is in anguish about Walt, and they felt like it was better to have a Michael flashback. But since they had already shot the Sawyer flashback, they had to write and shoot this Michael flashback extremely fast, and so they didn't come up with like a new story for him. They're just like, well, let's just retell part of the story, but it will highlight his anguish in the water. And it's, once you know that, it's really interesting watching this episode, because there are cutouts to the flashback that you can see how that was originally a Sawyer cutout, but it goes to a Michael flashback.
I think in this episode it actually works more in reverse. So when we come back from a Michael flashback, it's more telling that we're coming back to Michael.
Yeah. So I feel like I wouldn't argue with anyone that this is like one of the weaker flashbacks of the entire series. They shot most of it over a weekend. So I'm like kind of forgiving, because I'm like, okay, this is the best that they could put together. Whether or not
two rooms and outside park scene.
Exactly. And whether or not Michael as a character got a short shrift, you know, with this flashback or in general in the show, that's something I talked about, Steven, in sort of like our spoilery episode. So I'll stop like spoiling our own conversation, but I just wanted to like, that's the premise of discussing this episode. Cause when you take the flashback out, let's say there was like an amazing Michael flashback in this episode, or a really fun Sawyer flashback in this episode, this is a much stronger episode, because I think the raft stuff is really good.
And the island stuff is really good.
The hatch stuff is really good. And so it's just a flashback that you're just sort of like, meh. But like, can I take that out? It's a great episode, I think.
Can I defend the flashback for a second?
Absolutely.
Because there's a part of the flashback, and I think that's a pretty safe consensus that this is probably not one of their best flashbacks. But the scene in which he's saying goodbye to little Walt, Harold Perrineau just crushes it.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
Like, you see, and it's one of those things where there are moments on Lost where you're reminded that there are some really good actors on this show. And we get this a lot with John Locke, because Terry O'Quinn does it all the time, where it's like, oh yeah, Terry O'Quinn's a really good actor, by the way. Here's a scene. But, I think that's one of maybe the things that frustrated people with Michael's character, is you had an actor like Harold Perrineau, who's obviously a very good actor. And they didn't do enough with him to satisfy people who thought that he should be given more, which is probably right.
Yeah.
But I think that he does these things in little moments. Like, he just straight up crushes this scene. And then when you hear the story that it was like shot over a weekend, it's like, man, he really brought it for like that one day. And, I think that his performance in the scene where he's saying goodbye to Lil Walt is absolutely heartbreaking. You know, it's just like, you see it. And I think it helps that it's the flashback for his anguish on the water. But, either way, I think you see his whole, like, him just falling apart, basically, quietly. Yeah.
So I had a weird thought when I was watching it, and I usually don't like to rewrite television this way, especially old television, but would it have worked better for you if he was telling Sawyer the flashback?
I don't think so.
All right. I think when they come back...
Well, you tried.
Well, I think when they come back and they have that last cut back from the flashback, and he's in that moment of anguish on the pontoon thing, and he has like his head in his hands, and Sawyer finally realizes, I think that is when, I don't know, both performances despair really opens
Michael,
up to
that's,
me.
That's when Michael really... became president.
Well, no, that's actually right after Sawyer got a chance to watch the flashback, and he was like,
Oh, shit. Yeah, I get it.
I've been a dick to this guy this whole time.
I don't think telling him because the whole function of Lost is that dramatic irony of us knowing more than people on the island often do about this character. You know what I mean? Like, so when people like say stuff to Sawyer, like, you just don't know how to love anyone, do you? Which is Michael says in this episode, something like that. And then we're meant to cut to a flashback where we see that's not the case with Sawyer. It's very much not the case. That's the whole dramatic irony point. So I don't think like Michael can sit there and be like, you know, the reason it's so important for me to fight for my boy right now is I didn't fight for him when I needed to. I let him go, you know? And, but we know that that's, you know, so like, I think to have him say it is just like ruins the subtlety of that Lost can sometimes achieve in that way.
Fair. I guess there's this part of me that's used to seeing like theater with like two people, you know, stranded on a raft or whatnot. And that's when they start telling each other their backstory so we could like get into it. And I was like, this feels familiar like that. Except, wonderfully shot, water sequences. I don't know. I mean, since we've, you know, started talking about the production of the show, just thinking that like they have to have like floating lighting rigs out there and that the guys are like always submerged in the water. Really enjoyed this time out on the water, which I don't think holds up for all of Lost's future water sequences. But definitely, for the second season, started off with a bang.
Awesome. I think you can really tell the difference between when they actually shoot out just beyond the shore, which Steven did here and does in the future. And then sometimes they just have to, like, probably for safety's sake, let's say they have to do like a major storm or something like that. They had to shoot in like a pool.
Yeah.
And I really think you can tell the difference. And there are just some of the most beautiful shots in all of Lost, in this episode. I sort of like poked me a little bit about this one nighttime shot where you see like both of them for like the one perfect shot Twitter account. But what's also true is that Neil had already posted a photo from this episode on One Perfect Shot. I remember it. It is them looking at the island at the end at like sunrise at dawn. And
oh yeah, I love a good landscape shot.
Yeah, just beautiful stuff. Like really gorgeous stuff.
They do, and I think they do a great job in the cinematography of making the island look huge. Which is one of the, like, it's a story point that they sort of just illustrate beautifully with their cinematography, which I like.
There was a lot of good, I don't think it's like straight color theory, but in terms of separating the storylines by like different colors this episode, we got a lot of, thanks to probably the Virgin Mary's reds, but the cave came off, you know, with a lot of warm colors. The hatch is starting to take on like this sickly green of like artificial light. And like, as Joanna was pointing out, nighttime blue ocean has a lot of blues and then like white shine highlights, so it's all all looking real good.
And sharks.
I know. I mean, I know that they, yeah, they had letting rigs on like boats around the actors. But to me, looking at that, those shots, it also looks like they sunk light below the raft, which would make sense.
Yeah.
But it's
if
just
they were doing it. They did it in a tank, right?
No, they did that in the ocean.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Whoa.
They were out on the ocean for like 3 nights or something like that.
Wow. That would be so hard to sink a light in the ocean and make it still appear.
Well, I think they were like just offshore, you know, okay. Not like super far offshore. But yeah, when you see Josh Holloway like shivering, like that dude's really shivering, I think, because they're out and it's like nighttime, even in Hawaii, and they're just like wet the whole time. So yeah. It's a great episode part.
It really
most
is.
Of it. Most of it is great.
It sounds like it was a real pain in the ass to make, but it turned out to be a great episode.
Worth it.
So before we get back to the hatch, just rounding out water time, they get back to the island at a not recognizable part of beach from what I can tell. And Jin comes out and says they're parts of a female cow running at them. From the island, and we get some shadows of people carrying clubs.
A pretty silly shot.
A really silly shot. Well,
like, no matter what you know about the show, I'm just saying they like digitally enshadowed those. Like, what would be casting that shadow on those people is my question.
Right.
So it looks like kind of silly from that point of view, you know?
Right, because they're not ready for us to know some things.
Yeah.
What I do like is that they've made a point of calling out sort of how long they had been out there and then how big the island is. So it really throws further confusion onto who the hell that is that has Jin at the end or that's going to maybe take all three of them. Because it's like, we don't know if those are the same, I guess, others that, the camp is currently dealing with. We actually, at the time have no idea. Like what the hell is going on? And I really love that. I love that it's just, it's not anything we even remotely recognize. Well, it feels completely new.
Yeah. At this point we have, what Sawyer presumes are others that have, you know, boats and guns. And then we have these others that are carrying spiked sticks and whatnot and seem to have tied Jin up, with, you know, stuff that could be found on the island. So it's, I guess they're all technically others because they're all not our Lossies.
They're all not us. That nice tribalism theme. well, and we should mention, I don't think we mentioned that, you know, for commies, right, that we got a shark shot, with a logo on it that matches the logo that says Dharma on Desmond's jumpsuit. And the logo that's on the food in the pantry in the Hatch of Mystery. So, that's fun.
The shark one I remember. Okay. And, we're going to have to be careful about this one.
Yeah.
In the calm. But
I was just very careful just then, I think.
I do remember this is one of the first mysteries and people did ask us for theories and stuff. If you pause while the shark is swimming by and you lighten it up. Like if you brighten, I guess you would turn your contrast on your TV up, way up. So it would white out. You can see a logo, that matches the logos from the, Dharma brand food that's in the thingy on the shark. It's great. It was like one of my first internet
isn't
things.
Isn't that what I just said?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is.
Well, I was just. You had to, but you can't see it if you're just watching the episode. You have to stop it.
Well, yeah.
And then lighten it.
I talked to Steven about this, how this is like a very, 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 very early example of like freeze frame, you know, TiVo mm-hmm. moment, right? They already had one with the numbers on the hatch, right? But Dave showed me a behind the scenes feature, and one of the guys on the show admitted that they lit the scene brighter than they meant to. So I don't even know if you need to turn your contrast up. Like one of the producers was like, we
you don't even need the Neil settings.
we made that brighter than we meant to. Right, Dave? Am I remembering that?
That is correct. It's sort of, it was an Easter egg that they thought would be fun, but they didn't mean for it to be as apparently obvious as it is. But this is the beginning of one of my favorite parts of Lost, which is spot that logo. You are now on alert. If it could pop up on the tail of a shark, keep an eye out everywhere else in the island. And, you know, we don't have to bleep mentions of it in the future. But yeah, it's let's go down to that hatch of mystery. It has like a little dining area with some artificial light. Apparently, Desmond has been down there for a while. He's waiting for a man with a secret snowman password, that Locke for a while tries to bluff as being him. Desmond, doesn't fall for it when Locke doesn't have the answer to the snowman password. And he asks, Locke how many of the survivors got sick after Locke explains the plane crash. As we know, none of them apparently have been sick, but that does seem to line up with both the quarantine on the inside of the hatch and, Rousseau's tales of, you know, some kind of dark territory sickness. Desmond's injections, perhaps. That would make a lot more sense if he's warding off some sort of sickness. Yeah, but we get a little bit more time in the hatch. I don't know if we get to any more answers in the hatch, but we do get to see the computer operated that Jack didn't get to touch. And one of the few people that has... Well, no, that's not true. Hurley's talked to Charlie and Hurley's talked to Jack, but Hurley has not talked to Locke, who has to input the numbers into the computer, and two of our weird story threads continue to connect through characters that don't know they connect yet, which, you know, could be frustrating if they were willfully withholding information, but I find thrilling here in this, like, weird structured storytelling where every, you know, answer also comes with another mystery with our
boop, 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 boop.
Well, and I love the questions that we get out of the hatch now. How long has Desmond been down there? Why are there two beds?
A long time.
Food. What's going on with food?
Did you see all the hatch, the day hatch marks on the wall behind him? And that,
yeah.
When he's like, yeah, long time.
Yeah, the hatch is just it's a basket of mystery inside a jungle of mystery.
Some mole person.
Can I go back to the shark for 2 seconds?
Sure. Let's go back to the shark.
I just found a fun fact about the shark that I think is important for everyone to know.
We're going
to
be retreading this for the shark flashback episode.
Right. This is not in a question, in a response to a fan question on the official Lost podcast, which Damon and Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, we'll talk about this more later. They did during what I think the final season.
No.
For the last couple of seasons. Yeah. They did name the shark Ezra James Sharkington. So that's the shark's name.
Excellent.
I'm glad. Yeah, just
that's a
fun fact.
That is a fun fact. What does the J stand for, do you think?
James. Ezra James.
James. Sharkington. Oh, you said James, not just J.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the hatch stuff. Before we zip over to the storm, the hatch stuff that I love, I mean, we get the number stuff. That's crazy. Kate's a real badass in this episode. Let's shout out, you know, like we complain about Kate when she's annoying, or when she's annoyingly caught in something. But like the reason why so many people like her is that she's incredibly capable in something like this, where she like John McClane's her way up into a vent. I wouldn't. I would just like Locke would give me that knife.
All the candy bars.
No, Locke would give me that knife, and I would never get myself untethered.
Like, why did you put the knife right in front of my pants? That's where I can't reach it.
I will say this: despite the weirdness of the way John puts that knife into Kate's pants,
yes,
which
great.
Is weird, and he could have found a pocket. I love the moment, sort of the moment of truthiness of this sequence where John is like getting him to, is sort of manipulating Desmond to get Kate to be the one to be tied up. And he's sort of giving Kate, he knows that Kate will do, he kind of just knows that Kate's going to do the thing that he needs maybe to help, you know? And, it's sort of like you see that survivor level teamwork kick in. And Kate, like, immediately recognizes what John wants her to do, for the most part. Except, I don't think the end is really useful. But yeah, I love how it sort of just kicks into gear. It's like, oh, our team, is with our team, you know?
Yeah.
And Desmond is not on our team.
So we should say really quickly, this episode aired September 28th, 2005. The first episode of the official Lost podcast was November 8th, 2005. So,
oh, all right.
Very soon they started this podcast. And we'll get into it. We'll talk about it. Let's talk about when it actually started, because
sure.
this is, I agree with you, Neil, this is like a huge moment in like TV fandom in general.
Mm-hmm.
Access to creator wise, interaction with fandom wise. So, that's a big part of everything, but we will get to all of that. But yeah, that's all the Hatch stuff that I think I want to talk about. Y'all ready for the storm?
We could get ready for the storm. Do we need any moments of non-storm falling
down? Well, our Don't Fall Down award, our Don't Fall Down on the Island, or Don't Fall Down 2005, whatever you want to go, goes to Jin for falling down on the beach as he's running away from these shadowy figures with spiked gloves.
Also, worth noting, no Australian accents this week.
Yeah, thank
you. So there's not a bad Australian accent winner.
Thank a koala.
Right. Luckily, Michael's whole, all their legal stuff happened in America.
We have the Leslie Arce Memorial Ironic Statement Award. It goes to Michael Dawson for saying to teeny, teeny, teeny little Walt, "Look how big you are." When, of course, the actor Malcolm David Kelly was very tall, which we saw when
he had a massive growth spurt in between seasons one and two.
So tall, they had to kidnap him.
Tall, soggy Walt.
And then, Neil, do you want to introduce our new recurring segment on the podcast?
Yes. It is time for us to tie ourselves to a tree in a jungle of mystery and explore this week's Jungle of Mystery moment.
This is going to be great.
I'm glad that the lack of reaction I'm hoping was laughter.
Oh, I thought you were going to then say what it was.
Oh.
I was waiting for you to say what it
was. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
The Jungle of Mystery moment this week is the logo on the shark. It's really the logo, as Dave mentioned. That logo is one of the great Lost MacGuffins, as like you will want to keep an eye out for the logo. People immediately seized upon this as a thing. I remember this back in season two. The logo, very big deal. So the fact that it's on the shark is just fucking weird, but it's a very big deal otherwise.
So we are no longer doing the most 2004 thing about episode unless some like egregious thing crops up, and then we will talk about it.
Right. We'll probably get to like a most 2008 thing or something.
Maybe. But right now we are doing a Jungle of Mystery moment, is our new thing. You get to hear Neil's drawl every week. This week, Jacquino Corner actually belongs in the storm. So don't Google what the Jacquino track was this episode. Jacquino Corner is going in the storm. And that's it.
Yeah. Don't do any shenanigans or you'll have to live through your own boonerl.
Yeah. Is it time for an interview, Dave?
Well, we're going to get to our interview with Stephen Williams right after this word about cats.
Okay, those of you who've been following the podcast for a while, like, I don't even need to tell you how much I love my cat, who's got many names, Juniper, Junebug, Bug, the intern, all of them. But by far the worst part about being a cat owner is dealing with the cat litter. It's messy, it's smelly, it's heavy. Can I just say it? Conventional cat litter is outright barbaric. That's why I switched to Pretty Litter. Pretty Litter is kitty litter 2.0. It's shipped right to my door in small, lightweight bags that last me the entire month. What am I, Kate Austin? I can't have these like enormous bags of litter.
Oh my God. Big bags of kitty litter are so freaking heavy.
They're really heavy. They're genuinely
I remember that from when I was a kid. It was terrible. My mom used to make me carry them.
Yeah, so no more running to the pet store, storing heavy open bags of cat litter in your closet. Pretty Litter has next level odor protection. It uses super absorbent crystals that actually trap and conceal odor and moisture. No smell, no mess. Forget about that dirty clay or compost that's completely gross to clean up. But the best part about kitty litter is it even monitors your cat's health. Pretty Litter changes color to detect underlying illnesses before urgent medical care is needed, saving you money, stress, and potentially your cat's life. Dave, I know you hate cats, but you also like me and you want me to be happy. So can you tell me how I can get pretty litter in my life?
Yes, you could do what we all do who love cats and make the switch to pretty litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and using the promo code STORM for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code STORM for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code STORM.
I want to just really quickly introduce this discussion with the great Stephen Williams. And I just want to say, if you have watched the show, but are not a subscriber to our Patreon already, I suggest you sign up because Stephen said some really interesting things about Michael that we can't talk about in the calm, in the storm. He's friends with Herod Perelnau. He has some really interesting thoughts about what, how Michael's story goes from here. And, I really, really urge you to check it out. I was really, intrigued and interested by what he had to say about it. The most of our conversation is here in the calm, with the great Stephen Williams talking Lost and a little bit of Watchmen, spoiler free Watchmen. Please enjoy.
Hey, Joanna, it's Stephen Williams.
First thing I want to say is, so these are some of the most beautiful shots of Lost ever, both at night and then there's some stuff at like dawn and pre-dawn that is just absolutely like jaw-droppingly gorgeous. But then I can also imagine that filming all that stuff in the water with the swimming, with the raft, and I think you've said as much, was a nightmare to film, like film on the water like that. So I was just wondering if you, what you can remember about the challenges of filming all that raft stuff there.
That part I can remember. So, you know, this may be a strange way to kind of approach answering this question, but so when Spielberg did Jaws, 1975, I want to say, it's one of the few movies, if not the only movie, that he has gone so insanely, radically over schedule on and over budget on. In part, it was due to mechanical issues with the shark, with Bruce, the giant shark.
Right.
But it was also because he insisted on shooting at sea, on the water. And there are few things more challenging in this line of work than shooting on water. I, even though I was aware of that, because I am a huge Spielberg fan, B, a somewhat avid student of film in general, so I was aware of the pitfalls of trying to put this thing together, you know, not in a tank, not with the various craft attached to a dock, but actually like shooting at sea. But it felt like the gamble was worth taking for all kinds of reasons. First of all, the water just behaves differently when you are at sea. Secondly, the actors, more importantly, the actors behave differently when you're actually at sea. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to get equipment out. I think if memory serves, we literally towed the actors and the crew and equipment out, you know, half a mile, maybe even a mile offshore, and we're in pretty deep water. And, yeah, it's super challenging because everything moves independently of everything else. So lighting, there's a craft, a separate craft that the lights are on, another craft that the cameras are on, another craft that the actors are on, and none of them are tethered together. None of these three elements are tethered to each other, so they all move independently of each other while they're on the water in very, very unpredictable ways, depending on the wind and what the water's doing. And it's just, you know, across every vector of measurement, it's challenging and difficult and foolhardy, and yet we insisted on approaching it that way. And, you know, I rewatched portions of the episode this morning in preparation for this interview, and I can see the exertions of the actors in several of the frames, and it made me feel that I had not put everybody through hell for no reason.
Yeah, can you get specific about? I'm thinking of there's one shot where you know, Josh Holloway as Sawyer has sort of pulled Michael up, and they sort of collapse on top of each other, and they just look genuinely actually bone tired, exhausted. Are there other moments that stood out to you?
For sure. First of all, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say this, but Harold Perrineau, who is not only an amazing actor, a great collaborator, and a good friend of mine, is not the most proficient swimmer. In fact, in preparation for this episode, we kind of, you know, beseeched him to take some rudimentary swimming lessons. But he, even by the end of that, you know, he is not confident in the water. And so it's really kind of, you know, a challenge to ask someone who's not confident in the water to be at sea at night, where there are in fact predators. So we had, you know, we had safety divers underwater with devices that were designed to keep sharks at bay and any other predatorial species that might live there. But, you know, in addition to trying to stay focused on the task at hand, namely portraying the role of Michael, who's just had his son abducted,
yeah,
you know, he had to try and concentrate on staying afloat and not actually drowning. and then, you know, they're fully clothed. They're wearing jeans. They're wearing, they're wearing clothing. And so all of that is an additional weight and, you know, is an additional obstacle to buoyancy. So, it was just exhausting for them. And the water's cold.
Yeah. There's a shot of one of them shivering, and I was like, that's a real shiver. They're just cold up there in the water.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we had, you know, heating pools waiting for them on shore, but, you know, they still spent lots of time drenched and at night.
Yeah.
So, not comfortable. Not your cushy Hollywood gig.
I wanted to ask you, you know, I interviewed Damon for the season one finale, and I was talking to him about his collaborative work with his directors, with Jack on this one, with Nikki on Watchmen, with Mimi on Leftovers, and you rose up the ranks from producer, supervisor, producer, eventually an EP, and by the end of the series, you know, I read an interview where Carlton and Damon were basically like, Jack and Steven and Gene, like, run Hawaii themselves. So I was just wondering, like, I know you've directed on other shows, can you talk about the difference between being a director, and you're an EP on Watchmen, we should say. So, like, being a director in that more collaborative sense versus just being like a visiting director on another show.
As an executive producer or a co-executive producer, your area of responsibility broadens. So you are responsible for, you know, in an ongoing way, the comfort of the cast, the comfort of the crew. You're there to provide whatever help or assistance and clarity you can to visiting directors. But also just in terms of, I think more specifically in terms of the question you asked, there's a level of trust that you accumulate with each passing season with your key collaborators, and everything starts with what's written on the page. Everything starts with the scripts. And I had, in fact, worked with Damon before Lost. This is like, Watchmen is my third show with Damon now. I had done
episodes
of Crossing Jordan, Damon had written, which is where we first met, then reunited on Lost, and then again on Watchmen. And you know, there's just the writing department was in LA for the most part. Every now and then Damon or Carlton would make the trek out to Hawaii, but that was relatively infrequent. So it was really left to Jack and myself and Gene to kind of oversee and, you know, keep the show pointed in the direction that I think we all wanted it to move in creatively. So yeah, it's a more comprehensive umbrella kind of responsibility that you have when you're a producing director than as opposed to just a visiting director.
Does that kind of partnership strike you as rare from what you've seen in other TV working relationships?
Specifically, and particularly as it pertains, I guess now, you know, with Watchmen, the level of of mutual trust between Damon and myself has just deepened and strengthened and just gotten more profound. So, yeah, there is something very, very specific about the relationship with Damon. He is just, you know, a singular writer in our medium and with a particular voice. And for whatever reason, his scripts make immediate sense to me, and I am, he and I are generally on the same page and in very close sync in terms of what needs to happen to execute those visually.
One of my favorite conversations we've had around Lost was in the season one Michael episode when we talked to a friend of mine, Matt Patches, who was not a dad when he first watched Lost, but is a dad now. And watching the Michael plot, he's like, I'm utterly destroyed by you know, this thing that became sort of like a meme, a joke, this like screaming Walt into the void. We are right. Like it was a joke for so many people, but like then if you're a parent or a dad, especially perhaps, like it takes on this absolute horror that like those of us who were too young to know, like couldn't get when we were watching. So I was just curious, like, what was your connection as a father shooting this Michael storyline? And all the Walt screaming.
That is a great question. Not only am I a father, but at the time, I was a father of twin boys. I still am. They're both. I still am a father of twin boys, but they're actually young men now. They'll hate that I just called them boys. But at the time, they were boys. So it was the father-son dynamic between Michael and Walt was one that I was very, very familiar with. And you are right. It did become a meme. Soft ridicule, I would imagine, went along with that meme. And yet, when I think of that episode and when I think of shooting those scenes, they were really affecting to me because, yeah, I could completely empathetically put myself in Michael's shoes and imagine what would happen if my son was absented from me, either by virtue of the dissolution of the marriage or just in a purely more abrupt and violent abduction. And so it feels to me like that, you know, kind of plaintive, screeching howl into the night that Michael engaged in, you know, just repeating Walt's name over and over again is literally the only thing you could do. And in fact, would do it. It feels true. It felt true then. It feels true now. And I dare say, you know, if we were to hold up a mirror to ourselves at like key, critical and emotionally defining moments in our lives, we probably would not. We probably wouldn't think they were TV worthy either. But they would be true. See, you know. Hence phrases like ugly crying.
Right.
That I imagine ugly crying would probably become a meme really fast. And yet I'm sure that, you know, we have all ugly cried at some point or another.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it just felt true. That felt like that's exactly what he would do. And of course it was then kind of mirrored, in a way that was both touching and amusing when Sawyer starts calling for gin.
Right.
You know,
and Michael's like, oh, I thought we had to save our voice. I see.
Call. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I thought we weren't doing that. Calling people's names, hollering people's names into the night.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, Harold has given some interviews about how much he likes this portion of Michael's story when we see, both in the season one episode and in this episode, you know, a father, a black father fighting so hard to be, you know, with his son, and how that was maybe counter to some of the narratives that we often see in Hollywood of black fathers. And I was just wondering, if you connected to that at all, if you had any thoughts around, you know, these early intentions around Michael.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, Harold probably would have articulated that way better than I possibly could, but that, for sure, was feathered into those scenes. An awareness of that, that kind of notion that is, curiously enough, From what I can gather and from what I've read and from my own personal experience, is statistically an inaccuracy, this myth of the absent black father. From what there are, in fact, recent studies that suggest that black fathers are as much, if not more, engaged than lots of other fathers. So, yeah, just to see that and not kind of contribute to the wealth of pathologizing a paternal relationship in terms of black families, given that there is already a plethora of that presentation in our mediaverse, that was definitely something that we were all aware of at the time. And yeah, I think Harold's right to point that out.
Well, so another thing I wanted to ask you specifically about this episode is, you know, we diehard fans already know that this was originally supposed to be a Sawyer episode, that there was the Tampa job sort of storyline that was shot and discarded. You know, I might ask you some questions about that in a second, but that means I would imagine then that you have a kind of a tight turnaround in pivoting to crafting a Michael flashback and shooting a Michael flashback. So do you have any recollection of, I don't know, having to put that part together rather quickly in your production timeline?
I do. There were only a couple of things that I feel free to talk about as it pertains to that. But yeah, I think that what happened was, you're quite right, there was episode 202, the second episode of season 2, was initially conceived as a Sawyer episode. But then at a certain point, we all kind of collectively started talking about not just the material, but the larger story that we were telling. And, you know, the kind of climactic moment of the preceding episode had been about the, you know, abduction of Walt. And it started to feel inorganic to us that we would not pick up that thread right immediately in the ensuing episode, and so that was the bad news. We were like we had barked up the wrong tree. The good news was that we were all on the same page about what needed to be done. Yeah, there were a lot of late nights and there were a lot of long days, and if memory serves, we shot a huge amount of, like, you know, the Harold with his soon-to-be ex-wife and their legal teams and all of that stuff. We shot a lot of that on a weekend and a huge amount of that material. But we all felt like we had a certain kind of wind at our backs while we were doing that, even though we were up against it in terms of meeting schedules and so on, because it felt like we were back on the right track in terms of telling the macro story. So, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a, it's funny because there's an out to a flashback line that I think is Michael's. It's something like, you don't know what it's like to care about someone at all. And I can see how easily that could feed into a Sawyer flashback, but it feeds into his flashback. And I was like, oh, you guys are so lucky with that. You had that there waiting to feed you. So, yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I know that the Tampa job is like, this is footage you guys have never released. This is like, we've put it in the vault. We're not going to show it. But it seems pretty clear just from the description that exists already floating on the internet about what it's about, the fact that it has an actor in common with a later Sawyer episode, that it got mostly repurposed into a later season 2 Sawyer episode. Do you feel like that's an accurate characterization?
Yeah, I feel like here's what I would say. I don't feel like we cheated the audience or our fans out of any narrative information that they have not now caught up to. If memory serves, that episode was really a bit of backstory about Sawyer being a grifter, you know, being a hustler, which we fans of the show are, of course, completely aware of and cognizant of and familiar with. So it's not like there's something kind of earth-shattering in that material that would change anybody's perspective about either the character or the show if they were able to view it. It's just that just felt like the wrong beat, not the next beat in the story that we were trying to tell.
I think some people, and including myself sometimes, have a misconception that, you know, if a director's name is on the episode, they directed every shot of that episode. But this episode shares, like, overlaps with the previous episode that Jack shot. And so I'm wondering, you know, is there some stuff in here that Jack shot? And, you know, you obviously did the hero's work out on the water, but, you know, like, how much of an overlap is there from time to time between directors sharing scenes on the show?
Yeah, look, that's also a great question. I mean, the only way to answer that is kind of boring nuts and bolts of production, financing, scheduling, and so on. So it happens most frequently between producing directors. Like, Jack and I would divvy up work in a way that was not necessarily confined to the discrete parameters of an episode.
Right.
So, for example, if I was directing an episode that was on the water or on a raft, and the, you know, there was an episode on either side of that that also involved same location, same actors, I would in all likelihood end up amorting the costs and the time allocation for all of that work, because it would just be more efficient from a, on a macro level for production. And that most frequently happened with Jack and I. So, but it happened throughout the rest of the episode, the rest of the season, so, or the series. I did probably 99.9% of all the water work that appears in all the seasons of Lost. But yeah, I cannot remember offhand how much of a drift was an overlap with stuff that Jack had done for Man of Faith, Man of Science. Mm-hmm. But there may well have been, and it certainly would not be unusual or atypical for him to shoot stuff that wound up in my episode or anybody else's episode for that matter, and conversely the same for me.
I love that you're the water guy. I mean, did you ever sigh in like trepidation when you get a script? You're like, oh, look at all this water stuff. This is going to be me again. Back on the
I love being, look, I loved everything about being in Hawaii. Everything about being in Hawaii. Loved being in the water. Look, Hawaii has the most amazing group of water specialists who, as a general rule, refer to themselves as watermen, and I apologize for the gender specificity of that term, but I'm rendering it as I have heard it used. And their ability to, those guys have just this insane relationship to nature in general, to wind, to water. It's really, it's remarkable. I could bore you with a thousand anecdotes of, like, literally, you know, there was a guy called Brian Keilanu, who was one of our head water guys, who is from a very, very esteemed surfing family on the island of Oahu. And he could literally look day or night into the sky, into the heavens, and at the water, and tell you when it was going to rain with a degree of specificity that defies the laws of science, what the waves were going to do, how the currents were going to shift.
Wow.
And just being around those guys and osmotically absorbing their relationship to their environment was inspiring on so many levels and humbling on an equal number of levels. So yeah, once the initial sticker shock of like, oh no, more water work wore off, it was replaced by an appreciation of what I've just mentioned.
All right. And so speaking of water work, there's a, you know, we get a lot of the, you know, I feel free to call it the Dharma logo, even for our newcomer listeners, because it says the word Dharma on it on Desmond's jumpsuit, but we get a lot of the Dharma logo in the hatch, right? You get it in the pantry, we get it on Desmond, yeah, etc. But so this is a big moment for like Lost mythology. But you guys put this little Easter egg in where you get a shark with the Dharma logo on it swimming by, and I know that my understanding is that you meant it as sort of like a quick little Easter egg and did not think that so many people would notice it or latch onto it. But of course, Lost is at the beginning of this like obsessive TV watcher, slow everything down sort of environment. I know you worked on Westworld, you're working on Watchmen, you are well versed in these kinds of fans. Was that like the first time you were really aware that people are going to freeze frame every moment of your episodes to be looking for things?
100%. And it became increasingly apparent that every single thing we did was going to be scrutinized. And beyond that, that meaning, sometimes intended, sometimes unintended, was going to be imparted to every facet of every image. And in the early going, in the early stages, we were taken somewhat unawares by, you know, just the degree of attention to the minutia within the frames, and thereafter had to be, you know, as vigilant as we possibly could. But I'm sure we missed stuff even in that environment. But yeah, that was quite revelatory for sure.
Well, then what power does that confer to you as like an on the scene, producer director, you know, maybe Damon and Carlton aren't even there and you're deciding, I don't know if you're one or your production designer is deciding what books are in the background of a shot. And then all of a sudden you have Lost fans reading those books because maybe there will be meaning in them for what the show means.
No, we thought about it a lot and we talked about it a lot. And, in most cases, there was nothing, certainly around books, specifically around books.
Right.
But the same is true for tons of, you know, other kind of artifacts that appear in the frame. We talked about that relentlessly, and they were, in most, if not all cases, specifically chosen for the way in which their content or their form refracted and reflected the meaning of the of the particular story that we were trying to tell, or the character, or the moment that we were trying to tease out or illuminate. So, yeah, those were chosen consciously, and we were thrilled when people actually started reading those books.
I feel like I would abuse that power and just put in a book that I think is really good and people should read.
that had nothing to do with Lost.
You know, the fans should really read this one. I'll just shove it in there and we'll see if they pick it up. So
that lends itself to all kinds of potential abuse.
Right.
You could, like, if you were a writer yourself, you could like engage in a wanton act of self-promotion by putting your own book in there.
Why didn't more people do that, for sure? Or you're like your other work, your movies should be in there, something like that.
right, exactly.
All right, let me finish up and thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. Let me finish up with a few Watchmen questions for you. I'm curious, you know, I asked Damon a similar question, but I'm curious what thematically
you asked Damon about Watchmen?
Huh. not who knew? I just asked him about thematically what he feels like links, you know, Lost to Watchmen. I also threw in Leftovers there, but since you didn't work on that, I'm just wondering, you know, what you think. What are the preoccupations of Lost that you see visited again in Watchmen?
Wow. I think Damon has, you know, I don't mean to be evasive or I don't mean to not answer your question, but I feel like Damon, A, is not only the best person to answer that question. I think that the answer to that question that I have heard him offer is the best one. And
okay.
I feel like I have nothing to add. I will say only this, which is not in fact an answer to your question, but is tangentially related to it.
Sure.
In some of the early reviews of Watchmen, people have said, you know, it's good. It's a good thing that, you know, Damon worked on Lost because he's familiar with the flashback structure and that serves him well here with Watchmen. And I just think it's kind of interesting and funny because it's really the opposite way around, as he himself has frequently said, that it is the structure of Watchmen, the flashback chapter by chapter in the original graphic novel that informed him, his structural choices, or many of his structural choices when he came, when it came time to write Lost. The cross-pollination between those two at the level of form and structure and construction of an overarching narrative is pretty clear. As to thematics, there is no person better suited to answer that question than Mr. Lindelof.
Great. Then I will refer any listeners to an earlier episode of this podcast.
Yeah, perfect. I endorse that.
when Damon approached you to work on Watchmen, what if any connection did you already have to the source material, and what about the project itself in a way that people who haven't seen many episodes yet can safely listen to excited you about working on it?
You know, I had never read Watchmen before. Never. I was familiar with it, obviously, as a title. It's in the zeitgeist. I had a passing familiarity with it, but I had never read it. So the first thing I did was I immersed myself in the graphic novel and discovered, much to my surprise, that it was justifiably praised in the way that it is. It's so incredibly dense and rich and brave and deep and layered, and I could go on and on and on. It's just such an amazing piece of work, both at the level of, you know, illustration, visual presentation, and just textually, scribally written. So that was the first thing. And then I became interested to see what the iteration that Damon had in mind of this material, how he was going to utilize this material, because I was, in addition to being aware of the graphic novel, I was aware of the fact that Zack Snyder had done this very, you know, faithful cinematic rendering of this, of the source material. So I then read the pilot, and once I read the pilot script, it became clear to me how he was going to remix this material, and what the stakes were thematically, and that became, you know, amazingly intriguing, intimidating, foreboding, but intriguing. You know, at the center, it was always him, and my faith in his unique ability to tell stories for this medium and to write for this medium. I mean, he really is a unique voice. I you know, it sounds like sycophancy, but it's there for, you know, it's really true. His voice is unique. It's singular. And I had faith that that was a journey that, as potentially dangerous and ridden with pitfalls, it could be, it was the right time to get out of our collective comfort zones with this material and in this way. And that sense of trepidation never left us throughout the entire making of this thing, the almost 2 years. That sense of terror never left us. And I should not even be invoking the past tense at this stage. We still live with a daily sense of knowing why we made the choices that we did, but still, you know, just hopeful that those choices will be appreciated for what they were, because they were all made consciously and hopefully with the right impulse.
All right, now is the time of the show where we thank the folks that make it possible, the folks who get to listen to all of our bonus content and go watch movies with us. We're about to watch the movie Hocus Pocus by the time you heard this. We will have already watched it with our Patreon subscribers like Josh Kaluza, Lex Gernon, Ryan James, Emma Maltz,
Alex Bondano, Jamie, Violaine, Emily, Kelly Donahue, Sean Hammack, Abby Ademchek, Michael Weir, Melissa Shippey, Dahlia Marin, Michael Mora, Lewis Walker, Adam Barnum, Sean Patrick Marks, Claudia Davis, Chip Mims, and Annette Monnery. Thank you guys so much.
And I would also like to thank these people whose names I will probably mispronounce, but as always, if you jump in the Slack and give us a pronunciation request in the Small Council channel, we'll take care of it for you. But here we go. Thank you very much, and Julie Mahoney, Brian Ohm, Martha Petrashevsky, Will Wallace, Seth Harper, Vic, Kenny Malone, Cecilia Nilsson, A. Will, Hannah, Will Neville, Tone Kristen Laganay, I'm going to assume it's French, Skip Bujanig, Michael Caswell, James Barda, Kathy Jones, Norman Thompson, Zim, Kat Stromberger Perez, and Tatiana V. Thank you very much.
Guys, guess what? I have a list as well, but I am probably going to mess some of these up. These are the folks I would like to thank: Lori Carmichael Howell, David McGillivray, Caroline of the North, Mark Harper, Priscilla Walton, Jenna Paul, Amy, Jackie Pawlowski, David Matheson, Andrew, Stephanie Jenner, Kaylee Hicks, Shane Yap, David Adams, David Moran, AJ Cabbage. Yeah, there
cabbage.
We go. Yeah, cabbage. it's missing a B, otherwise it would be cabbage. Anyway, Del Martinez, Steph Deal, Liz Bisline, Josh Brown, and Rochelle Rawlings. Thank you all very much. Yeah, I should say that last part.
We're back for the storm. Let's pick up with some of the things that we pushed into the storm this week, starting with our Giacchino Corner.
Yes, Giacchino Corner. Neil, you want to give us Giacchino Corner?
Yeah, Giacchino Corner introduces a motif for the tailies.
Oh, those unnaturally right shadowed people end. With clubs.
Right? Well, and what I love about that, now that we can talk freely about it, is that, like, they really shadow out Mr. Echo, but, like, the,
Yeah.
Who's the other woman that's there with the,
Libby? Or Cindy? No.
It's Cindy. Cindy. Yeah.
Oh, it is Cindy. Cindy. No. Yeah.
It is Cindy. Yeah. And it's like, she's kind of shadowed out, but it's like, we can't show you this other guy just yet.
Bernard is also there, and he's like, I think they like got someone completely incorrect for Bernard.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they maybe still had not cast him. Yeah. So there's a lot going on. Giacchino introduces their theme, which will obviously become a big thing. I guess they really don't show up in force until episode, what, 4 of the season?
Something like
or
that.
Or are they a big part next week?
I haven't watched next week's episode.
I think you're right, Neil, that it's like 4.
Well, because we talked about how these sort of 3 episodes go together, and I feel like that's, you know, once we get to Everybody Hates Hugo is when we sort of settle
right, because orientation is very hatchy.
Right, orientation is very hatchy, and then Jin, Michael, Sawyer spend most of the time underground, not knowing what's going on
in a pit. Well, don't we get a lot of Michelle Rodriguez next week then, though? Well, we'll find out.
Yeah, I don't think we meet her, though, until the end. I don't know. We'll find out.
We should
watch the episode and see what happens.
Yeah, we'll watch the episode. But yeah, they got some time to get their taily ducks in a row.
Right. It is interesting that they introduce it here, though, the musical theme. I'm not sure why, but that's interesting.
Our usual segment here, which is Lock Antagonist Check-In, is going to be replaced this week by an email from Pat. Is that cool with you, David? It has to do with villains in the show.
Oh, yes. Then let's hear from Pat.
Okay. Pat says, the undisputed villain of Lost, and then in parentheses, you can dispute this. And then Pat asked to save this email until season 4. But since that's clearly not happening with my Swiss cheese brain, I apologize, Pat. we're going to read it now. Dear Lost Heroes, for episodes and episodes, there's been some on and off again discussion if John Locke is the villain on Lost or the antagonist or, I don't know, tragic anti-hero or whatever. Often this leads into the assertion that the true villain of Lost is still on the horizon. Usually Ben Linus is referenced or the Lucifer adjacent Man in Black. No doubt those are bad dudes, especially in relation to the flawed but mostly wholesome characters who we root for on the show. But I think that neither Ben Linus nor the Man in Black fully embrace villainy. They are sympathetic aspects. There are sympathetic aspects about them that confound me. Even though Ben is a creepy manipulative tool, I feel sorry for him at times, despite myself. And even though I recognize that the Man in Black is coded as a villain and that he does terrible things, his elemental nature makes me want to put him into some other category. I think he transcends morality by virtue of his supernatural nature, in the way that Reed Richards would argue Galactus is not strictly evil, for all you comic book fans. Okay. Charles Widmore has that classical Tywin Lannister-esque villain feel to him. He's certainly an ass, but he falls in that same zone that Ben Linus inhabits, where I recognize that he's a bad guy, but perhaps not the worst guy. But season 4 does bring us the worst guy on Lost. Do you guys want to guess really quickly who Pat means?
Season 4? Ooh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That mercenary guy who shoots Ben's daughter.
Oh, yeah. Kevin Durant's character.
Nailed it. Martin Kimi, played by Kevin Durant, is the worst person on the TV show Lost. This ruthless mercenary embraces villainy in a way that no one else on the show does. His cold-blooded murder of Alex Rousseau was irredeemable. He's so bad that in the extra-spatial, extra-temporal afterworld that those attuned to the island get to move through in season 6, Kimi is not part of any redemptive track, but is instead a classic criminal to be overcome. Because when it comes to Constance, as much as it's Desmond and Penny, it's also Kimi and being a malefactor. Now, is it possible that Kimi can be the villain of Lost and be dispatched in season 4 with 2 seasons to go? Well, maybe. If you asked me who the villain of Game of Thrones was, the absolute worst person, it wouldn't be anyone who made it to season 8, it would be Ramsay Bolton, who might not have been the existential threat or the primary antagonist, but he was just the worst piece of crap. Thank you for your time. Best regards, Pat from Maryland. So, what do we think about Pat's definition of villainy here, Neil?
I mean, that guy's definitely bad. So that's true. I do think that there are, Lost does give us characters who almost are primarily one thing eventually. This is the thing about Lost is every character is not exactly what you expect until we meet a couple characters who are exactly what they appear to be. So even Lost falls into that eventually. And I think Kimi is one of those where it's like, they just kind of need a bad guy in season 4 because there aren't really many bad guys, or at least not that we know of yet. So he's a pretty good one. But I agree with that. I mean, the answer for Locke, as we've experienced every week, is that it's not that simple.
Well, and I think he makes a good point that it's not that simple with most of the antagonists on the show, and that Kimi is like, you know, whatever. I don't know. What's Kimi's D&D alignment, Dave?
Oh, lawful evil.
Lawful evil, right? You know, that's like, there's no shades of gray there, and like why that's such a good moment, not just the like shock of it, but also just the fact that, you know, that Ben is like, oh, I hadn't come up against this kind of good versus evil yet. You know what I mean? Like, he thought he was playing a different game. Kimi's playing a different game than the one Ben thinks he's playing.
Well, if you want to make the argument that he is the villain of the entire series, you would have to say that if Alex doesn't die, there's always a way out for Ben of his ultimate fate of being manipulated into killing Jacob, because if Ben doesn't kill Jacob, then I don't really know, you know, who else has been rejected that purely by the god figure to stab him.
I think most clearly villainous, not the villain, but most villainous, which is maybe sounds like a silly distinction, but I think it's where we're circling. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I don't know. I mean, does Lost have to have a villain?
Well, but that's the whole thing about Lost.
Also the question we're not answering.
That's the whole thing about Lost, is that like it's about you finding empathy for people, like, you know, even like early season one Jin. And then you're like, oh, but I misunderstood that guy. So like even an evil cloud of a nefarious cloud of smoke that does a bunch of bad stuff, in the end you're like, oh, Titus Welliver.
Right,
oh,
right.
I'm sorry.
Oh, he was trying
that's
there.
Like the magic. He was trying to, that's the magic of the television series, but the magic of the island is it draws people there to test them. You know, it's going to bring Locke and Sawyer and real Sawyer all together in a fucking ship, like, later on. Like, it does have that mystical element of testing people, so doesn't there have to be an evil to test the good?
But isn't that also the thing kind of about Keevy and his crew, is he's not there to be tested.
Yeah.
He's just there to kill people and be bad. He's like, well, and it's like that's the whole thing about him.
Well, and it's a Widmore fuck up, right? Like, Widmore and his, like, possessive devotion to the island, like, brought an evil to the island in order, you know, to get his, what he wanted. So, yeah.
He's like,
he could fuck with the island.
It's like Michael Biehn in, The Abyss. Where at first you're like, this is a professional. And then you're like, oh no, he's got deep sickness.
Did I ever tell you about the podcast I wanted to start a couple years ago called Been There, Done That, about the films of Michael Biehn?
I'm going to guess you would do two episodes before Michael Biehn would call you and be like, why am I not on this podcast?
Yeah, why is that not just an article? Why is that not just a podcast hosted by
Michael
Biehn?
Yeah, why is he not doing that podcast? Get Michael, B's listening to the Storm Part of a Drift, give us a call.
Give us a call, hey, Michael B. We have a project listening for you. I'm really serious. That's not a joke. I've talked about doing a Michael B. podcast.
I'm sure nobody's pitched him anything called Been There, Done That before.
Are you being sarcastic?
Yeah, yes. I'm sure somebody's pitched him pun titles on his name.
What a bummer. All right.
I'm sure the mid-90s were horrible for pitches for Michael Biehn.
Michael Biehn is such like a weird dreamboat.
Or, as he would be known on Lost, Michael Biehn.
Biehn.
Four million Biehns.
4 billion Michael Biehns. Yeah.
What else happens? Stormy stuff happened. Oh, we wanted to know about some top theories. People want to know about some theories. There was a fun one that I just found that I thought was interesting. There's somebody wrote an article, Big Unanswered Questions Going into Season 2. One is, who will Kate fall for, Jack or Sawyer?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, guys. Why was Locke in a wheelchair? This was a question that plagued everybody. And mostly, who are the others? The others seem to be a huge fascination, and you can see it in this episode where they sort of throw, you know, they throw the Taileys in there and make them out to be the others. But, you know, I think the fascination around the others is one of those interesting ones, because by the time we're done with this season, we're going to have a much better idea of what the others are.
By the time we're done with this season, we're going to have a group defined as the others, but... Yeah. It's, I am very happy we got through the entire calm section without me freaking out about how happy I was that Locke presses the button for the first time! Press the button! This is what the whole season's about, him in that room pressing that fucking button. It's great. Here we go. Let's
do it.
Well,
it's great too.
Becomes a desk jockey again. Oh, bye.
Execute.
This is, to me, similar to what I talked about earlier with Harold Perrineau and the way he's so good in that one scene and that otherwise not so great flashback. The moment where Locke stops, like pauses and starts asking Desmond questions about what's going to happen is just really great, because it's like, Locke's going to do it. Like, we know Locke's going to do it. He's going to press that button. But I love that he's still sort of living on the edge of like, I'm going on faith here. Like, he's like, well, what happens if I don't? What's the island going to do to me? You know, sort of thing. Locke and the button are obviously a big thing that we're going to get into.
Yeah.
We should say in the storm, because they snipped the Tampa job, which we heard about in season one, they snipped the Tampa job out of this, episode. That story goes in basically into the long con, which is, we don't get a Sawyer episode till episode 13 of this season, because they had to snip his flashback. And the Long Con is the one where he falls in love with Kim Dickens' character Cassidy, who wouldn't. But they had a different actress playing like the Mark that he falls in love with. I think she's a Star Trek actress. I don't have her name in front of me. But Kevin Dunn, who plays Gordy in that episode, was in the Tampa Job stuff. So it's like really clear that they were just going to do that story, but in Tampa. But if you want to see, there are photos of Josh Holloway in like real Florida gear, sunglasses, like a sort of like Jimmy Buffett shirt, white pants. It's great. It's some great shit. There are photos of that online. So they shot it. We'll just never see the footage because they're never going to release the Tampa Job cut, is what I have to say about that. But yeah, basically, we would have seen like Sawyer falling for a woman. And is there anything else I want to say about the Tampa Job? But it's referenced later. Nathan Fillion says, his character says something about an ex-con in Tampa or something like that. So, you know, there's a lot of mythology around the Tampa Job, even though we never see it. So.
Yeah. And then, like, as we said in the column episode, next week, we're probably going to dive into more Hatch thoughts because we will have our orientation film finally.
We'll be splicing film together next week, Dave.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic.
Just to see what's missing.
If all works out, we are going to have the perfect guest for this episode. If it all works out.
Okay, good.
No matter what, it's going
to
be a great guest.
I was about to just say, don't make me bleep the something that is a false promise, but that was perfect.
No.
It's going to be good. It's going to be good. All right, cool. Neil, where are we going next week?
Having to bleep something in the storm would be a real next level. Yeah,
that's how deep down the rabbit hole we are. Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, Dave, we're going back down in that hatch for an episode called Orientation. It is a John Locke episode. That's why I say we're going back down in that hatch, because we're going to get a lot of John Locke stuff, which I'm sure will turn into a lot of John Locke conversation in the storm, like it happens every week.
Yes, and finally, our season 2 theme won't include spoiler bits of dialogue, because they are from Orientation. Great. All right, cool. Until next week, when we're watching films and pressing buttons, where can people find you online? Let's start with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I got some great interviews floating out there in the universe. You can hear me talk to Tim Blake Nelson of Watchmen over on Still Watching. Or you can hear me talk to Lord Dern on Little Gold Men. So, you know, some good podcast content for you this week, guys.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at FilmSchoolRejects.com. Catch me on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot, where, yeah, we're sneaking some Lost in there. I actually have a couple from this episode I might pull out. Also, don't forget to follow our show at Storm Podcasts and email us hosts@stormpodcast.com if you would like us to answer your Stormy or call me questions.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. You could find me this fall covering The Mandalorian for Thrillist.com. So Star Wars thoughts there. And you could find me every week here on The Storm telling you not to fall down.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.